The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Unfiltered opinion.
Ideas and you're not quite sure why.
You secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Moyana.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters, live streamed every Monday morning for your viewing pleasure. This week's Market Matters is proudly brought to you by our friends at Trive. We thank them for their partnerships and collaborations and for them helping us to continue doing the work that we do. We're joined in studio by Trive's Trading Services Manager, Sean Dendere, to take a look at market movements and see if we can make sense of what's been happening. We're going to be taking a look at the clawback of tariffs, or not clawback. Or walk back, not walk back. We don't know what to call it anymore. We're looking at tariffs. We're also taking a look at gold reaching all-time highs. And we're going to take a look at some important economic data that will be coming out this week, if that even matters. Sean, good morning. Thanks, as always, for joining us in the studio. I see they got the spelling of your name right. They got everybody's names right this week. So that's always a plus. There's no I's.
Did you
there's
explain
no dots
my name,
on the
though?
I's. I did not.
Oh, beautiful.
I didn't have to explain the name, and that's what made me extra happy about it, was that it was spelled properly and we didn't have to do it. We're still waiting for our community to give us some name suggestions on what to try out, because I'm sure this doesn't always end this well. But now that we've got a good base case for what we hope is going to be good spelling, we'll see how the rest of it shapes up. But let's get into market matters. We try on the show. We genuinely put in an A-class effort to not discuss the orange Mussolini every week. And every week doesn't...
Okay, so I've got somewhere we can start with.
Okay.
Although it's...
We'll circle back to him eventually.
Goldman Sachs says gold could plausibly trade above 4,500 by the end of the year.
That's Goldman Sachs' call on the gold price. I would believe it.
Gold miners, if that happens, gold miners, their profits more than double from
it. I want to trust our own reliable gold source. We all know who it is. She's not here. She called $3,200 a fine ounce. Shout out to Mushima. We will have her back on the show because I want to see if she agrees with the $4,500.
Dollar no, gold. Not 4,500, 4,000, right?
4,500.
4,500, there you go.
So like you said, Mishima said it, right? Believed her. So every time, right, I go onto a show and they ask me, Sean, what's your stock pick? Simple, straightforward. Guys, just go and get a gold ETF and sit. But the rest of the other stuff, leave it to professionals. Mm. Because like you said, clawback, reprieve, are we inside, are we not inside? But gold has technically been consistent. Mm. If we go back historically, look, when there's uncertainty, what happens? Mm. Gold shoots up. I do believe that is going to go to that 4,000 mark. Going back, was Goldman Sachs said it, right? I think they already called at 3,500 mark by, like June or something.
Yeah,
so by the middle of the year. Gold is going to reach 3.5. So I guess they are seeing further growth in that price.
Well, I suppose they're all seeing the same thing. And
we're seeing.
We're all seeing the same thing. And we're seeing your new trading strategy around downloading Truth Social. And I want you to tell us about that, because that is informing probably what Goldman Sachs is looking at from a risk perspective.
No, 100%. Look, technicals, fundamentals, you know, that is the traditional way, you know, to trade. I don't want to call it the safest way. By the way, everyone trading is quite risky, but it's got nice upsides to it.
And this is not trading advice from Sean Dendere or the Trive team.
Thank you. Look, it's simple. In my opinion, just download Truth Social. You don't have to interact with anyone there. Just follow one person, Donald Trump. Make a notification on your phone. And once he tweets, see what he says, or I don't know what they call it on Truth Social once he publishes or whatever. Cool. Take a position, because whatever fundamentals that you're looking at that point in time, whatever technicals you're looking at, just throw them in the bin. Game over. You said something else.
Folks, that was not financial advice. The show does not provide financial advice. You've seen the disclaimers, and we have the disclaimers in audio as well for you to listen to as well. That was not financial advice. That was Sean's opinion based on the current market activity, which isn't
but
wrong.
I like it.
I mean, if we think back to Trump version one, I say version one because that was his first presidential term in office. Every time he opened his Twitter or his X or whatever you want to call the platform now, the market moved, right?
Exactly.
This time around, and we spoke about this as well, Cy and I spoke about this about 2 weeks ago, to say now the tweets don't really have the thing, right? Because one, Truth Social is a platform there, the news drops there first, but also the main thing around it is executive orders have been the flavor of the year.
Lovely.
From January 6th, right? So where something isn't explained in or articulated in a Truth Social post, you can best believe there might be an executive order that'll follow around it, right? Hence the tariffs. So again, we're back in that cycle of where do we go from here? And I remember asking Cy this question when he was announced as president-elect last year, when we did our Christmas specials around that time towards the end of the year. And I said, do we think it is physically possible to have a more volatile second term than the first term? Because you remember how the first term was.
Very volatile.
And I didn't think it was possible. And I don't remember what Cy said. But whatever the outcome of that conversation was, boy, were we wrong.
Yep, it is more volatile. And the thing is that if you're in a constitutional democracy and you're Liz Truss and there's a lettuce and you last, 40 days or something. The trick with Trump is that there's only really three ways for him to exit: death, resign, or Section 25 of the Constitution. None of those are happening. So we've got another 3 years and...
What's Section 25 of the Constitution?
I think it's impeachment, is it
not? No, impeachment. But
yeah, he survived two impeachments. No, I wouldn't bank on impeachment.
Section
25
is when you're mentally incapable.
Mentally incapable.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that requires a lot of proof.
It's not section. I think it's an amendment.
How do you... I don't even want to know how you prove that.
So basically what happens is your cabinet, it's 25th amendment. Basically, it would be... It's his vice president and his cabinet.
Okay, so this is why you appoint the vice president that's not going to ask questions.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's the 25th Amendment, addresses presidential succession disability, providing for the vice president to become president if the president is removed from office, dies, or resigns, outlines fulfilling it, et cetera, et cetera. But part of it is also for incapacity. Now, the theory is that Reagan was incapacitated for the last 2 or 3 years of it. The thing is, no political party wants to do it, right?
No.
You put the man there, now you got to take him away because orcs.
Mm.
So the short answer is, outside of death, and to be clear, you know, you wish death on no one. Trump is old and obese, but he's there for another 3 years, 9 months, and 7 days.
You make that sound like such a long time.
It is a long time.
Yeah, Sean.
I have a question that I had. I asked Simon this question off camera.
Yeah.
Right, but I'm going to pose this question to you. In your opinion, since we're speaking about volatility, right? These markets that we're currently experiencing versus COVID markets, in your opinion? Simon gave his answer, but I just want to hear what your thoughts are.
In terms of volatility these times, so COVID was a very simple thing. Nobody knew what was going on. The entire world went into a lockdown. It was a market crash, collapse, down to a level, done. And we kind of found that base and held at that base until we started to come out of that, or until we got good news. It was one direction. This is markets come down an hour later, markets are up an hour later, they're back down. So this in
red
terms
light,
of
green light,
exactly red light, green light, Squid Games all over again. In terms of volatility, this is far more volatile than COVID. The COVID pandemic, much like the 2008 financial crisis, was a sell off. One direction, done.
Fair.
This is the Wild West. You are on one side of the field. I'm on the other side of the field. Whoever draws their gun first survives. And then when you survive that, you have to go play red light, green light. It's like that level of volatility. And you can start to see it in the fact that different market participants are approaching it differently. Institutional is looking at it one way. Retail traders and investors are looking at markets another way. Long-term asset managers from a retirement perspective are looking at it another way. So think about something like crypto. When crypto was introduced, all of the retail market was saying crypto is going to you know, go to the moon. Then institutional got involved and you're like, okay, maybe crypto will be more controlled. Now retirement funds can't get into crypto. So you see how different players play around differently. Now, unfortunately, with the level of volatility that you have, there are certain mandates that go off. So in the asset management and in the fund space, if a certain stock or a certain sector or a certain event happens, they are trigger events, right? So my investment mandate says if I lose more than 10% on something, 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 I must liquidate.
Exactly.
And so you're seeing forced liquidations. Not that we wanted to liquidate, but forced liquidations in line with mandates.
Yeah. And so 2020, the S&P was down 32%. We're only down 12% at this point with the S&P, 12.7. Fun fact, in 08, it was down 55%.
Oof.
Hit the low in March 09.
See? And then when we hit the pandemic, we came down to that March 09 low, stayed there, didn't bounce off of there erratically.
Well, no, it went up pretty quickly. I mean, the 09 bottom was March, and then it was back at highs by Feb 13. So it took 4 years to get to the highs. The pandemic, we were back at highs in April, August. So
yeah, when the lockdowns were lifted.
Sort of 5 months. No, yeah. August 2020.
August of 2020. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the bear market of 22, which was down 20-odd%. I mean, in terms of direct downness, this is like, there's one in the last 20 years, it's a number three, it's just beating the 2018 sell-off. In fact, no, not quite. So it's only the fourth, one, two, three, four, fifth worst so far in the last 20 years. The difference, as I said to you before we clicked record, is that every other crisis that I've ever seen, and I can go back to 87 on crises, is that
it's a lot of crises.
Everyone in the world is frantically working to try and solve it.
Yes.
This time, not everyone in the world is frantically trying to solve
it. That's because this time, not everybody in the world caused it.
Yeah, fair. And that's the difference.
This was a single-handedly, like one-sided driving factor behind the volatility. The global pandemic, we can at least argue that the entire world went into shutdown. Everybody had to protect their own countries. All governments had to make different policies. The 2008 financial crisis, everybody had to liquidate their positions depending on what they were exposed to. This time around, none of the market participants have caused this.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fun fact, China says it's just detected salmonella in American poultry. Don't mess with the Chinese.
Well, speaking of not messing with the Chinese, I want to look at that before we jump into some of the data that's coming out today. The response around the tariff walk back from a market perspective. For a bit of context, when the announcement was made around where we are going, Capitec went down to 2,500 rand. Sasol went down to 55 rand a share. These are just local counters, right? We're not talking much bigger companies.
Exactly.
Today, as we sit here, Capitec is back above 3,000 rand. Sasol is back at 66 rand a share. So the reversals and the swings are far more erratic and far more volatile. Yes, some of these companies have underlying issues and all of that and all of that. But let's be clear, something like a Capitec that moved down to 2,500 was entirely the announcement around South Africa and the tariff imposition on the South African context. Nothing to do with Capitec's performance, right, as a share. And you saw that with First Rand as well, coming down all the way to below 60 rand, back at 70 rand now. So markets have behave that way. And interestingly enough, from a Chinese perspective, you'd expect that that would have happened. There was that one day where the Hang Seng lost 13%.
Yeah, but it'd been close on the Friday, remember?
That's it. So they were kind of recovering from all the movement that didn't happen. Now, when you look at markets and you look at the walk back or not walk back, you've now got two different sides of the story. The American side of the story, American businesses, American business people, entrepreneurs, those that are big Trump supporters are like, no, a walk back is not a sign of weakness. It shows that Trump is willing to negotiate and he's trying to explain the seriousness of the situation to China, and it is for China to come to the party and all of that. And a walk back is certainly not a sign of weakness. And then you go on social media and you see the memes. The memes don't agree.
Well, yes, who doesn't also agree? So Larry Fink, CEO BlackRock.
Oh, there we go.
I think we are very close, if not in a recession now. Jamie Dimon, CEO JP Morgan, recession likely outcome.
Okay, wait. Let's just put that into context for our audience in terms of assets under management at the moment. For BlackRock.
Isn't BlackRock biggest in the world?
It is the biggest asset manager, right?
It's not biggest by a small margin. It's biggest by a long shot. The Vanguard Group sits at $9.3 trillion in the US.
This is dollars, guys, by the way.
This is more trillion than SA Inc. US dollars. BlackRock is $10 trillion US dollars. For context, that is a third of the entire United States' debt. Their debt sits at $34 trillion.
Oh, you kicked that door open.
Well, I mean,
US tenure.
Well, there you go.
When was it? One of the days last week. I forget which day. I wake up, I get up 4:30, and the tenure is on my watch list, always has been. I never look at it because it's the most boring thing in the
world.
Move,
really?
It moves down to like minute little basis points so far off the screen, you've got to zoom out to see it. And the thing was collapsing. I had, which of course collapsing means yield up, price down. I'd never seen something like that happen before. It was like in real time, it was collapsing. And that was when Trump then did the big walk back on Wednesday.
I really want to touch on that point, right? And this is going to go back to your point about the markets turning around. I don't think it was a walk back in terms of, oh no, we're coming to the negotiating table, et cetera, et cetera. I think it was really economic pressure that pushed him to say, okay, guys, sorry. Let's negotiate. Because we're looking at the US bonds, right? They were becoming less attractive. The dollar was becoming less attractive. So technically speaking, I mean, all US indices were crashing, inverted commas, right? So if I carry on this path as make America great again, right? Or whatever the slogan is these days, surely I'm actually just smashing the country down. So someone should have said to him like, look.
No, but Sean, that was the plan. So remember, if the whole plan behind this, and this is the conversation we had about genius or maniac and whether or not this was all the strategy, if the entire plan from day one was to bring down the values of things and to readjust valuations and to allow for someone like the Federal Reserve to have to cut rates. This was the plan. The plan was to reduce the value of the dollar, was to come into a situation where the global markets weren't at the heights of the valuations that they were, right? So almost like a reset of sorts. And that was the point that we argued to say that if that was Trump's plan all along, there are so many different ways he could have gone about doing that. And this was probably the most extreme way to do it. But if that was the plan all along, then you were on the right trajectory. I think what you're saying around the market reaction was the market didn't anticipate that it would happen that quickly and violently,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so now you don't know where to from here. Because if you crash, I mean, if we come down and we crash to, say, pandemic level, and we break through pandemic levels, and we go back to 2008 levels, which were also seen in the pandemic as well, the moment you go below 2008 financial crisis levels, now it's every economy must recover for themselves, and even if you can pull it out of the hat as a United States, there's no way you're going to pull it out at the rate that China's going to do. So inherently, like, I think kind of gets to the point that you're trying to make, I think, Sean, around the fact that you run the risk of tipping your market out of being the largest market in the world, which China's already projected to exceed America in a couple of years' time as being the world's largest economy. And if that happens and you accelerate that process, you take away all of the power that America used to have as the largest economy.
And the power's gone. See, here's fun fact, staying with 10 years, and I'm rounding up to the nearest 10th. You know, United States, 4.5%. Germany, 2.5%. United Kingdom, 4.7%. Spain, 3.2%. Italy, 3.7%. Japan, 1.3%. China, 1.6%. G7, the US has the second highest tenure. And they've also got the highest debt. Mm-hmm. And about $9 trillion needs to be refinanced in the next 12 to 18 months.
There we go. And of that debt, between Japan and China, they sit with 5% of that US debt, right? So,
well, do they? Because here's my other fun fact. So when the market was crashing, if China really, really, really wants to play like nasty sand
pit, you load up on debt.
No. You've got about $800 or $900 billion dollars of US debt. You sell it. So you then crash, because remember, you're selling debt, price down, yield up. You sell it. This takes your tenure to 5.5. And then you go to Europe and you buy European debt. So you make American debt massively expensive. You make European debt massively cheap. And you say to America, and now showing who actually has the power. Remember the whole thing. Bond markets are irrelevant until they aren't. And when they are relevant, they drive the global economy. China could flip this whole thing on its head by giving Europe generational cheap rates and by giving America generational high rates.
This is something that reminds me very much of something that we saw on social media. And it sums up Sy's point perfectly. The United States got into a global tiff and chose the worst people to go and have a math war against.
Yeah. Remember, China is my best example. So I'll give you two. Firstly, when the pandemic hit, China just locked down their country for 3 years. No shit's given. They just locked it down. But fun fact, when England essentially took Hong Kong at gunpoint in the 1800s after the Opium Wars, and they signed a 150-year contract with the UK, they came back 150 years later and said, "You guys, contract, we want the island." And I bet you the UK is like, huh?
We don't even remember China, the paper that was written.
China works in centuries, in millennia. The rest of the world is working in tweets, 12 seconds.
There was a Chinese official who was on a South African broadcast station last week that came out and said, China's been around for 5,000 years, and for bulk of that time, America wasn't part of our trade relationships. So we don't really care about now, and we will be around for another 5,000 years. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but you get the gist of the idea. And their argument is a long-term perspective.
Massive.
You know the good thing for us from a South African perspective? Donald has left us alone for a little bit.
Not really.
But no, I mean, his main focus currently is China right now.
It is, but he said over the weekend that he's not going to be coming to South Africa for the G20 because horrible things are happening here.
February.
Absolutely, you did. You said that he was never going to even show up here. So he still believes that genocide and land confiscations and things are happening here. Interestingly enough, there was, I think, the president of AgriSA, one of our agricultural organizations, I forget the gentleman's name. I think it was Johan Meyer. I'm not 100% sure. He was on TV and he came out and irrefutably said, none of this is happening. And I remember because it was retweeted and reposted on X and all of that stuff. So the conversations from bad things are happening in South Africa to, I think the market is starting to see the South African picture and say, but Trump, you keep saying these things. Where is the empirical evidence that supports what you are saying? Now, we can get into the debate around whether or not these things are happening or not and all of that. But if you keep citing one video, and Trump did this over the weekend as well, which is a video of Julius Malema singing Kiel de Boer and saying, this is all happening. That video can be 10 years old and you're still citing the same video. You're not providing empirical evidence as to what's happening right now in the country and what's going on, right? Now, nobody's saying that these things may or may not be happening. That's a completely different conversation. But for you to come after South Africa as an entire country on the basis of whatever other agenda you're trying to drive, because let's be clear, this has nothing to do with our policy on expropriation, those policies don't matter because the United States has an expropriation policy of their own that they conveniently forget to discuss when it comes to things like this, right? Conveniently, it doesn't exist. If it's in the... What is it, Si? If it is a strategic benefit or strategic
or eminent domain or
asset
anything,
or whatever that the United States believes as a strategic line, advantage to them, they're allowed to do that. So there's carve out in the United States legislation that says if it is of strategic advantage to the United States, they can do whatever they want. How is that any different?
All countries have it because you want to build a railway line. You're not going to let One Oak say no. You want to build a new city or something. You're not gonna, every country has it. But I mean, it's like everything, right? You can look at the same thing from two different directions.
That's it. So again, from our side, it's not a policy thing or whatever. But like you say, for him leaving us alone, I think a part of it as well, the market is also starting to be like, South Africa's not that bad. So I'd be interested to know from a South African perspective, what our yields look like on our treasury. Because I'd imagine from an emerging market perspective, we would have some of the most attractive bond yields at the moment.
Sure. And so our 10-year it's 11.2, which is ridiculous. Our 5-year is, refreshing, 9.5. And our 30 is 12.2.
So even if you don't take a long-term view on South Africa, and we're going to wrap it up on this note because I think we are out of time. Even if you don't take a long-term view on South Africa, over the next 5 years, from a South African perspective, South African government bonds are even more attractive than US government bonds.
So you get a 10-year at 11, call it 11. You lock in a currency hedge. Yeah, what's that going to cost you? I don't know, a percent or two maybe to lock in a currency hedge.
Call it 10.5, call it even 10%.
10%.
10%. You've reduced your currency exposure. You're in for 10 years. Happy days. You're the happiest person ever. But unfortunately, we have run out of time. Thanks so much to Sean for joining us in studio. Shout out to our TikTok community. We have never forgotten about you guys. You guys are absolutely awesome. Thanks for joining us on the live. We're going to leave Market Matters on that note. We're going to get into our deep dive and we're going to dive into what market competition looks like. At what point does market competition become too competitive and at what point does it benefit the consumer? We're going to look at a couple of examples. We've got some really great examples around the car sector, around energy drinks, around all sorts of different areas. years. And then in our investor insights, we're going to take a look at how to negotiate a raise. So stick around for those conversations. They're going to be dropping later in the week. But for now, that's been Market Matters. And we move on to our deep dive. This week, we are diving into competition and market saturation. We're going to be taking a look at what point does competition benefit consumers and perhaps at what point does it harm consumers. We're going to look at various industries, anything that we can think of, and see if we can really get to the bottom of this. Si, it's such a weird thing because so many different sectors have different examples, right? So I think about things like energy drinks, the energy drink market or the car market or even the e-hailing market. So Bolt versus Uber versus the traditional meter taxi. At what point do you kind of say too much competition is in the market? Because you and I have spoken about this from a cellular perspective to say there might be too many telecoms providers for the size of the market that's in South Africa. But I can guarantee you everybody's happy to have a Bolt and an Uber as opposed to the traditional meter cabs from a pricing perspective. So how do you strike the balance between when a market is competitive and that benefits the consumer and when a market just doesn't make sense because there's too much competition or there's too little competition?
So I think the too little is easy, right?
Yeah, because too little is easy. Monopoly, prices.
Yeah, duopoly, monopoly, whatever. But it is interesting in the when there's almost too much competition. And ultimately, what happens, I would imagine, is that, I mean, some of the folks are just going to get squeezed out, particularly smaller brands or smaller companies, because you're smaller, so you're less efficient, not because you're not good at what you do, but you don't get those economics of scale, so your margins are tighter. And you'll often see that sort of predatory pricing at the same time. When you come into a market, let's say we want to launch a new energy drink, well, we go look at the average price of energy drinks and we come in 30% lower and we just try and get everyone else out. Now, that's easy to do if you've got lots of money, and of course it might not work. But there must be a point at which some companies just don't compete anymore. Take Asia and I think even China. Uber exited. Uber was like, yeah, guys, we can't win here. So they sold their business to the incumbent and they've got a stake in it and all's good there. But they were like, we can't compete in this particular space. This is an overly competitive market and we can't get to scale. And the more competitive a market, the more you have to do to get to scale, because competition brings prices down, which brings margins down, which means you need economics of scale. So if you and I take our $100 and try and enter the energy drink market, we've got no chance because it's just too competitive.
Sometimes I agree with you on the point that economies of scale bring down price, but sometimes it's not even about how many participants you have in a market. So the energy drink market, as you say, one very good example, because there was a time where Red Bull dominated the market. They were the only player. And then now you've got Switch and Dragon and all of these other things. And now Red Bull says, well, we can't sell our Red Bull at the same price that we used to at 30 Rand for a 250 ml can. We now have to come down because there are cheaper alternatives in the market. And now we're being priced out. So that is something we have to adapt to. But the flip side of it is a Spa pick and pay Checkers ShopRite situation, where ShopRite dominates the market such that they dominate their logistics chain and the value chain there, that they can outprice their competitors themselves. Now, that market doesn't have a lot of grocery alternatives, right? So you've got the main brands. You don't have more than four or five alternatives if we include Woolies in there. So the market isn't overly saturated, but still, you go try and compete with ShopRite's logistics chain now and go and launch a grocer now. You're not going to survive, right? So sometimes it's not even about how many participants are in the space, but who's doing what in the space.
And how big they are and how efficient they are. If ShopRite had just been lazy, we would all be sitting here and there would still be a pick and pay and everything there. Let's pretend distribution centers never came to South Africa. They were still inefficient. And to be clear, the ShopRite distribution center, my wife and I were looking to buy something. We go to Checkers. If it's not there, trust me, it's not at the other Checkers either.
It's not. But now that saves you as a consumer as well. I now don't need to go drive to the other Checkers.
Because it's just not. They don't have it at the DC. But then weirdly, tomorrow, they've all got it.
Yes.
So if we didn't have the invention of DCs, well, the introduction of some 20 years ago from ShopRite, and we were all still bumbling along, prices would be higher. The mom and pops would be in a better place. So there would be some competition. There would be a small chance. In the current environment, environment. I mean, there's a grocer of sorts. He's mostly vegetables and stuff like that in one of the places on Jan Smuts Avenue that I go to for physio. So I will stop from there from time to time. This stuff's like makes Woolies blush with price, man. I mean, like, you know, but I stop there because the quality is really, really great, mm-hmm. because it's massively convenient, mm-hmm. because I like the oak, mm-hmm. but like, yo.
It's not going to scale out into a nationwide 100%. Franchise anytime soon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, exactly. Yeah.
But the other side of it as well is, I think it also now depends on sectors, right? So I look at the motor industry.
Mm.
Just this year alone, Mercedes-Benz has announced they're planning to increase their maintenance plan in a bid to attract more customers to a 7-year maintenance plan, which is something Mercedes was always known for in terms of quality. And I think they were one of the first brands to have a 5-year maintenance plan back in the day as well.
7-year maintenance.
They're now looking at 720,000 Ks. But at the same time, BMW South Africa has come out to say they're reducing the prices of their BMWs to make them more competitive. German companies are being outpriced in this market by alternative manufacturers. Most of them are Chinese branded companies coming into the market. So you've got a bunch of new entrants. Volvo's closing down 60% of its footprint in dealership perspective here. But now new entrants are forcing these things because now a South African, a consumer has the power because a consumer says, hang on, your brand is expensive. Here's an alternative that I now have access to. And therefore, you telling me that your brand is twice the price of what I can get as an alternative suddenly isn't attractive. So their new entrants are good for competition and good for the consumer.
Yeah, I agree with you. I would argue, however, because this gets interesting. So in the Chinese vehicle space, it was almost the Operation Warp Speed. What China does is they say, we want to get big into cars. And initially, it wasn't even electric cars. It was just cars generally. And they will help and seed and fund and give soft loans to dozens, hundreds of companies. And when they and fully expecting most of them to go bust, but they kind of tilt the market. Whereas all of this German fancy brands, well, they had to kind of make it on their own. So China kind of also puts their thumb on the scale at the same time.
I think what that comes to is something that I heard Stephen Bartlett say. Stephen Bartlett's the host of Diary of a CEO, for those who don't know. He came out and said that his team, and it's something that we've done as well within our own brand, within what we're doing at Insider, is rate of experimentation is so important. You have to experiment so much faster than your competitors. And that's what China's doing. China's willing to run 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 different experiments at a time, knowing full well that they're going to fail. But it's not about the failure. It's about which one do you get right? Because the reality is you don't need to get 1,000 of them right out of the 1,000 that you experiment with. But if you get 2 or 3 or 4 of them right, then you make up the money for the ones that you got wrong. Stephen says it best. We'll see if we can find the link to that particular clip and share it with everybody. But it was something that really stuck with me about everybody willing to step out of the comfort zone to try something new. We saw it with the EVs. EVs came out and Tesla was there. They'd been doing what they'd been doing. And everybody started to say, perhaps let's go look into this. But nobody went to look into it at the rate at which BYD did in China, at the rate at which Cattle Batteries did.
And the first EVs were 100 years ago, hey?
That's it.
I mean, and the Nissan Leaf was in the 90s. But I like the point that you're making. So the whole thing with evolution, people think it's the strongest that survive. No, it's those most able to adapt. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you're saying with China. They will put 100 out there, see how, and it's that adaptability in a sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, back to the key point. I mean, ultimately, more is good for a consumer. There is a risk, however, where it can almost kill an industry. And I'm frantically trying to think of an example, but
Where too much?
Where it becomes so overly competitive mm-hmm. that there's too much competition, that mm-hmm. there's just no margin left, and folks are like, yeah, thanks, but no.
So I would wager that number one, might sit in something like the energy drinks space, because now, I mean, there's so many energy drinks out there, you can get one for 10 Rand.
Yeah, yeah.
You can get one for 11 Rand, where in the past, if you think about how much a Red Bull used to cost, that was one example where it used to cost so much more. The other side of it, or the other industry that I can think of where it's become too much.
Intuitively, I think it makes sense. Practically, I can't think of one where an industry, what's maybe happened is that folks have been squeezed out and you left with monopoly or duopoly.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at
a complete collapse.
Well, yeah. So maybe it's airlines where it hasn't completely collapsed, but where, you know, at the moment, how many sort of viable airlines do we have in South Africa? Maybe 4.
Mm-hmm.
There have been points where we've had 8 or 9 and there's just too much choice.
Mm-hmm.
The small guys all Algo, Air Link, and Kalulu.
Yeah, because you're incurring the same. But that comes back to your point, Si, around the efficiencies. You're incurring the same amount of cost to operate your two-plane airline as an SAA is to run a 40-fleet airline from an individual plane perspective. Yeah. The cost of the fuel, the cost of the plane if you're leasing the plane, those sorts of things, right? So you're also incurring that big overhead. But if your seats aren't full and someone like an SAA can afford to drop the price of their seats because they've got other planes they can recoup it on or other flights. So if we take airline one that has only two flights to Cape Town versus airline two that has 10 flights to Cape Town in a given day, they can recoup the money. They've got more chances to recoup the money.
They can make some cheap flights.
That's it. So you can make some of them cheap, some of them not, and all of that. So very much dependent on efficiencies, like you said. Another example of efficiencies is the oil market. At anything above...
Yeah, that's a good example.
Anything above $50, everybody kind of makes money, right? But the oil price crash of 2020 showed us one thing very, very importantly, that the OPEC bloc and Saudi Arabia in particular can produce oil at the cheapest rate of any country on earth. So at the point at which your production cost exceeds that of Saudi Arabia, you're no longer competitive in the market in their eyes, because if we have a race down to zero on anything, they're going to beat you.
Yeah, and all I like, because also there's cheating. So OPEC says, well, OPEC Plus says cut back on production, but if because oil is falling, so what do? Cut back on production to hype it. Mm-hmm. But if I'm
demand
Nigeria, and supply. If I'm Nigeria, I'm like, yeah, but if I cut back on production on an already low, why don't I just produce more? Mm-hmm. No, there's you know, abilities to produce and get it out.
But even if you're a Nigeria, right, that is competing with an OPEC block, understand that you're competing with an entire block that does significantly higher volumes than you do as a single country. And so you are now disincentivized to produce more, even in that scenario where you can say, oh, I can just produce more, because you're not going to, number one, fill the demand. Number two, they can quickly reverse that decision, and now you've increased your production, increased your headcount and your overall cost, and you've now put yourself out of pocket in the market. So just because another competitor does something in a market doesn't necessarily mean it is in your interest to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. It creates an inefficiency for you, because you, again, efficiency and scale. You don't know at what rate they are able to do this versus at what rate you are able to do it. I think the input cost side of it becomes so much more of a discussion. Think about the production side of it. And we see this now in the China conversations. You saw, I don't know if anybody's been watching the social media pages this week or these last couple of days, various Chinese manufacturing companies have come out to give the input costs from their perspective for producing luxury goods, for producing these brands that are priced at ridiculous levels. And to that extent, I mean, I remember a couple of weeks or months ago, there was a, I think it was a court case even, where one of the big production houses, one of the big luxury fashion brands, got exposed as to the input cost of one of their handbags relative to their selling price. And so when you're looking at something like that, when you're looking at input costs and efficiencies and all of that, the moment you have a market like this where someone says, I can access it cheaper at this rate, it becomes grossly inefficient to imagine how you would then still pay for the price at a premium rate when you can get it cheaper.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually interesting, because there's the whole knockoff. Now, Red Bull are going to claim that many of these energy drinks are knockoffs, you know, in the sense that they're not Red Bull. And then it also plays into brand, right? Some people just like, I drink Red Bull, and like, I don't care about Celsius and all the others.
That's it. Brand loyalty.
Prime or whatever. I'm a Red Bull player there as well.
Mm-hmm. Brand loyalty is another thing. But I think there comes a time for consumers as well where brand loyalty doesn't matter depending on what it is you're looking to access. It comes down to efficiency of service and the deliverables that come out of it. And I bring up something like meter taxis that aren't brand specific, but from a service point of view, everybody, when Ubers and Bolts and things and alternative e-hailing services were introduced in South Africa, and everybody suddenly said, hang on, I can get a trip at a fraction of what a meter cab would traditionally cost me. The meter taxi market completely suffered for that, to the extent that they had wars against the Ubers and the Bolts and all of that. There was a revolt where people were said, you're outpriced or you're put out of the market so quickly because you had been, but that was an isolated example, because you had been a monopoly that suddenly wasn't a monopoly anymore.
And we were getting funded in those Ubers and Bolts by venture capitalists in Silicon Valley. I mean, we were doing it at below cost, to your point, trying to drive out the traditional meter taxis. Mm-hmm.
And efficiencies prevailed. Efficiencies won that battle. So there are a lot of factors to look at. And I think one of the other factors that we haven't really looked at is regulation as well. Sometimes regulation enhances market competition. And I think about something like the National Consumer Commission or something like the Competition Commission in South Africa, where competition is such that you kind of oversee it to make sure there's not too little or too much, or there's not people swallowing up other people and all of that. So the regulation side of it does play a role in it. Look at the latest Vodacom massive deal for fiber, right? The Remgro Group would have wanted the deal to go through. Vodacom would have wanted the deal to go through. The Competition Commission said, you can't do that. You're reducing the amount of competitors in the market. That's going to hurt the consumer. Yeah. So I think regulation in our country especially is there to protect the consumer side of it. And whether or not sometimes it's too restrictive and sometimes you must just let everybody fend for themselves. Because I also believe that there's a time where if you believe your product is superior, then enter the market and prove it to the market. Right?
Yes.
Come in, prove it. Yes. And if your product genuinely is better than what is currently out there, markets will naturally gravitate towards your product, whether it's premiumly priced or not.
Fair level markets.
Yes. Fair level markets. Again, that's an ambitious thing to say. Some markets are not fair. And yeah, but that's a very important point. So that some markets are not, they don't play by the same rules or they don't play fairly. And so you coming into the market, you come in at a disadvantage. So if you're entering a market at a fair vantage point to everybody else, and it's down to product, then may the best man win.
Yeah,
and if your competitor is so much better than, like you said, as you said in the China example, that you decide to sell out to your competitor, that was just a fair market scenario. Yeah. They didn't do anything to you that was detrimental to your business. Mm-hmm. You lost fair and square. Another one where you didn't have enough competition is the streaming services. We spoke about this 2 weeks ago. Yeah. The DStv versus Showmax versus all of these other things. Suddenly you've got new participants and people are like, hang on, do I really need this? Do I really need to pay for this? So market saturation might not necessarily be the best thing, but it's also not the worst thing depending on what it results in. So the car market is heavily saturated. But because it's a large item, it's a large ticket asset, it means that you then get a more efficient price and a more efficient service, and you have more choice. So the market saturation in that example is not bad, but at the same time, it can be terrible.
Particularly if you are the one making it. No, also, you're little Ford, right? You were the only car company.
Jeez. No, yes. Yes. But that's the thing as well, is now, from a global perspective, globalization has also become a factor here.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because now I'm not limited.
It used to be local. It I mean, I don't know, 1,000 years ago, everything was made within a kilometer of it.
Yes.
Now
I can import something from Australia, I can import something from China, I can import something via Amazon, and it will get here. There used to be a time where I didn't have access to other markets.
Yeah.
And so I had to deal with what was here. I had to contend with what was here. Another example of market kind of interaction, I've thought of one where competition doesn't necessarily result in a cheaper alternative. Microsoft, you've come into the space. You've dominated the Words and the Microsoft Office suite. There are Office suite alternatives out there, yet some people are still paying a subscription on a monthly basis because Microsoft knows that's how much of the market that they have.
I do that.
See what I mean? So there's an example where there isn't a lot of competition and there's a premium being charged and there are alternatives, but people still elect to leave those alternatives and go with what they know.
And sometimes it's because your corporate overlords insist. In my case...
Corporate overlords.
Yeah, in my case, I just pay it. Look, I get 5 accounts, a terabyte storage per each and stuff, but I mean, all of it is Google Sheets.
That's it. So you have an alternative you can access, but you elect to go for what is, I suppose, familiar and comfortable, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't really know why you did.
I was just so excited when it came onto the Mac.
Yeah.
Because like they never used to update Office on the Mac.
Mm.
Like they would, like every 6 years. Mm. And then suddenly it was just like, yep, here it is.
Another example, traditional cell phones. You used to get Apple, Sony, Nokia.
It wasn't even Apple. I mean, you go further back.
Right?
It was Sony Ericsson. It was...
Siemens, giving away age
and
now.
And Motorola.
There we go.
And
Nokia. You see, and so... Now, I wonder if you're going to get to a point where you look at someone like Samsung and Apple. Yes, you guys are the premium brands in the segment. But as a consumer, can I justify paying 30,000 rand for a new phone?
Actually, there was one the other
day. Does that make sense?
That Nafisa tweeted it was a 65,000 rand
trifold. Yeah.
It's more than my laptop.
That's it, right? So at that point, does it then make sense from a consumer perspective for me to go after that device? Or do I just get an alternative that is functional that answers calls?
And we're seeing that, fun fact and off topic, but the clampdown on Huawei and the others, the Chinese manufacturers, they've really got really, really good with their brands. And in markets in Asia, Apple and Samsung are like fourth and fifth.
And so, some of it, I suppose some of it is also down to the benefit that your consumer derives, right? And this is probably what drives that decision. Yeah. So you think back to the meter cab example, right? There was a time where you couldn't take a meter cab to get to a Gautrain station or to get to certain areas. You had to walk a certain distance because the Bolts and the Ubers of the wars and the meter taxis didn't allow for you to be picked up in certain places. That creates a significant inefficiency for consumers. But consumers were willing to do that because of the cost saving that they still got as a result of taking that alternative service. So just because it is there doesn't necessarily mean that consumers will use it. I think if you're building products and you're looking at markets and you're looking at market saturation, your first point of call before even looking at what your competitors are doing is what does your consumer want? And is your consumer willing to pay a premium for it, a discount for it, or a fair market rate for it? Then you then go beyond that and look at the other things.
Yeah. What does the consumer actually want?
Yes. And what is the consumer willing to pay for what it is that they want there? Yeah. Some are willing to pay a premium because it genuinely solves a problem. And they're happy for that premium to cover for that. Some just can't justify it. And there's a lot of things we can't justify out there. But we have run out of time, folks. We're going to leave the deep dive on that note. We're going to get into investor insights. We're going to look at how you negotiate a raise. And potentially if we add something to our wall. And then we've got a big announcement around our holiday shows coming up. There's a couple of holidays coming up with the Easter weekend this weekend and the holidays going into next week from a South African perspective. We'll give you an update around that at the end of the show. But for now, that's the deep dive. And we wrap things up with our investor insights. We're taking a look at how to negotiate a raise, some of the key things that you need to think about and look at, and perhaps we can find some useful insights from that perspective. This is going to be a particularly interesting conversation because I've got the master of raise negotiators going to guide us through this. This is, of course, Sai. He knows everything about raises because he's negotiated several of them over a very lengthy career. How do we do it?
So the first trick is if you want to keep the job or not, or fix a new job. No, if you don't.
Do you care about the job?
No, if you have loads of options, go in big. Go in absolutely big. But it is things like your KPIs, whatever your metrics are at your place.
Performance measures.
You need to be knocking that out the park. Yes. If you're not, you're out of it. Understanding what industry standards and averages are and that sort of thing. Go look. So a lot of companies don't put cost to company, but go and search the LinkedIn.
So do your research.
Go do your research. Mm. See if you can't get a counter offer. In other words, go to a competitor and see if you can get an interest out of them. Because what you do find is that oftentimes in industries, and I think particularly our industry, is that once you're in a position, your salary sort of goes steady. If you want the leap, you've got to move. Mm. So maybe it's not even a raise. Maybe it's to go work for one of the competitors, see what they have, what they're offering.
I found that can be a remarkably useful tool from a negotiation perspective, because when you have an alternative, a lot of the times we're afraid to have this conversation with employers and everybody because you say, but if I don't have an alternative, I lose my stream of income. And if they say no and all of that, then it doesn't work out from that perspective. The moment you have an offer from somewhere else, you have two things. You have an alternative to your current situation that you can make a decision on.
Yep.
And the second thing is you have a benchmark with which to see, have I been underpaid this whole time? Have I been fairly paid or have I been overpaid? So now you can see if someone makes you an offer and the offer is significantly higher than where you were, then perhaps you've been underpaid for so long because you've been at a certain bracket. Remember, companies don't pay you based on what their competitors are paying their friends. They pay you based on what you guys have agreed.
Yeah.
And in some cases, you get companies that overpay someone. So I think very easily about financial services, banks, your chief economists in banks, your CEOs in banks, everybody. So things like CEO salaries are public knowledge, right? And so you can see the difference between the Standard Bank CEO and say the Nedbank CEO in terms of salary. But that's because of their individual negotiations. Standard Bank doesn't go back to the CEO and say, hang on, we're going to pay you what Nedbank is paying their CEO. Because then as the CEO, you're like, I'm not the Nedbank CEO. Yeah. I'm the Standard Bank one. Yeah. So an offer gives you that flexibility, but it also gives you an idea of what benchmark kind of might look like and makes your negotiation that much stronger.
And to be clear, your bosses, your company doesn't care about your lifestyle. The fact that you can't make it on your salary is of no concern to them whatsoever.
Yes.
So don't come and say, I can't survive, I don't have enough money, I can't make ends meet. They're like, not interested at all. You've got to really go in and get hard research. Go and find things where you excelled. Was there a giant project that you won for them, or not a contract, or that sort of thing?
So that comes to what you're saying, Si.
Which is also then, it's not just your KPIs, it's also just keeping records during the period.
I was just going to bring that up. When you brought up KPIs, I thought about the fact that we don't often track what it is that you do. These are my KPIs. These are the deliverables I've delivered on. Mm-hmm. And this is where I have exceeded your expectations. And therefore, that's how I justify wanting a raise. Because you said I must do 1, 2, 3, 4. I did an extra 5, 6, 7, 8. And therefore, these are things that I've gone beyond what I was tasked with doing. Exactly what you're saying is keep a record of those things. It's so important to do that.
Yeah. And don't be scared to go big. Don't be scared. And it's also an anchoring effect. Put the number out first. If you want a 10 or 15% raise, don't say to the company, what can you do? Say, I want 20% and here's why I think I deserve it. And the reason you put a number on the table, as soon as you put 20% on the table, they're scared of that number and they're going to be freaked by it. That's cool. You've put in a, they'll come and say, well, okay, we can give you 15. In other words, go big because you, that's the reference point. If you say, I think 15, they're going to be like, well,
okay, here's
10. They're not going to go up. They're going to come down and
they will never go above your offer. That's important. That's important. I think the other thing to think about on that note around the conversations there is from an employer point of view or from a negotiation perspective, I suppose the worst they could say if you're asking for a raise is no.
Correct. Really? That's also a good point. They can say no. They can absolutely say no. But you need to go in there with the time. Also, don't go for a raise like 5 minutes after you just got a raise or 5 minutes after you just got the job.
Yeah.
You need to have, but go in with that ammunition. If you can find out what colleagues, a lot of companies will have salary bands and where are you in that band? You might be at the bottom. Say to them, I'm not looking to get out of my band. I'm looking to get higher up. Another trick, say to your boss, how do I get a 20% increase? What do I got
to
do?
So ask the boss to give you the metrics, then meet those metrics.
Then meet those metrics or negotiate them if you think they're crazy. Mm-hmm. Then meet them, then go back to your boss and say, remember 20%? Well, holla.
If you're going to do that, folks, get it in writing. The last thing you want is to increase metrics performance targets.
And the easy way to get it in writing is email the conversation to them.
Yes. Just to follow up on our meeting at this and this a time, is the objectives that we discussed. These are the terms for this increase. And then at the end of the meeting, at the end of the email, just so it doesn't sound like you're being authoritative or aggressive towards your employer, simply end the meeting with saying, have I captured the above correctly? Please let me know if I've missed anything. So it also puts the ball back in their court to one, confirm what has been stated, or two, give you corrected information. Either way, you come out with a win.
If the company's doing well versus doing poorly. Also, do you need a salary increase or could you negotiate your bonuses? A lot of companies just bonuses 13th check. What about saying, well, hang on a second. Why don't we maybe have a 13th, 14th, 15th and 16th checks? I mean, is there something you can do around the bonus part? So it's not, because that seems less scary to the company. If they give you a 20% increase, that's it for life until you leave or they
bonuses are once off.
But bonuses, they can renegotiate every time. So say to them, okay, so how about we set a bonus process?
You know,
what I have to do to get a 100,000 rand bonus at the end of the year?
Yes. That sort of conversation. Performance board, performance metrics, so that it feels as though it is a two-way thing. But there we go, folks. We're going to leave it on that note. We're going to see if we can update our wall. Are we liking anything local for the wall at the moment? I mean, we know we added Johnson & Johnson last week. Are we adding anything this week?
Is the JSE on there? The stock?
The JSE company is not on there. Like the JSE as a company. They're a profitable business.
They're profitable. Mm-hmm. They've got a shrinking market, but then they sell you everything else. And there were days yesterday when value was 40, sorry, days last week when value was 40 billion.
But they also don't have necessarily a shrinking market, because I've spoken to Dr. Furi and the team at the JSE. They're expanding into the African markets and other markets. So the JSE is starting to become something like the NYSE, where you anchor other smaller exchanges.
And there might be less companies,
yes,
but there's more instruments. The explosion in AMCs, actively managed ETFs, all of those sort of things coming
through. I like the JSE. I happen to, I like the JSE. I agree that we can add it to the wall in terms of the rationale that we have behind it is sound there. Where do we put it on the wall, though? That is the big question. So if I'm looking at where it's trading at the moment, the JSE as a company, JSE Limited, is at 120 Rand a share. I liked it better at 105 Rand a share from last week, but that's not to say that we don't find a lot of value in it.
I mean, forward PE is under 10.
Yeah.
Dividend yield is almost 7.
Yeah.
This is I agreed with you. There was price points last week when I liked it more. I think the stock is cheap, even at after the what we've seen in the last week.
That's it. And I think even coming from the 80 Rand kind of recent lows that we saw at the start of the year, I think there is still quite a bit of value there. There is going to be a lot of volatility that comes into the market. The company like the JSE will benefit from that, in that they don't take any trades, but they're a facilitator of those transactions and those sorts of things, which increases their transactional volumes. We like the JSE. We're adding it to the wall. We will put it... I suppose we really like it. Do we like it enough to be blue chip? That's our real question.
Yes.
Yes, there we go.
Brave.
We love it. We are brave. It is going in blue chip. That was not financial advice. This is our opinion on it. And if you have your opinions, we'd love to hear them. We'd love for you to share those opinions with us. Speaking of opinions, we've come to the end of the show. So it is time to give you our unfiltered opinion of the week. And this comes from the recent trend that we've seen on social media platforms, where all of these companies, all of these Chinese manufacturing brands have now said that their brands, or the brands that we know and love, are effectively all made in China. So the unfiltered opinion of the week this week is more of a question, and a question to our community is that, is made in China the new luxury brand? There will be no show next week and the week after that. Si and I are taking a bit of a break. We are both traveling, and of course it is a bit of a break in terms of public holidays. And it looks like Simon's already ahead of me. He's decided to get a head start on the holidays. But we will be back, and we will continue sharing all of our information and insights with you across our social platforms. So remember to like, follow, subscribe. Investing isn't hard. Just try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.